This is Audible.
Please see the PDF that accompanies this program for the illustrations and artworks that are discussed. The PDF begins with a list of the main characters in Leonardo's life and a note on Italy's currency in 1500, followed by a timeline showing important dates and events. To further appreciate Leonardo's art, you can search online for enlarged high-resolution reproductions. Simon & Schuster Audio presents Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson, read by Alfred Molina, with an introduction and conclusion read by Walter Isaacson.
Introduction. I can also paint. Around the time that he reached the unnerving milestone of turning 30, Leonardo da Vinci wrote a letter to the ruler of Milan listing the reasons he should be given a job. He had been moderately successful as a painter in Florence, but he had trouble finishing his commissions and was searching for new horizons. In the first 10 paragraphs, he touted his engineering skills, including his ability to design bridges, waterways, cannons, armored vehicles, and public buildings. Only in the 11th paragraph at the end did he add that he was also an artist. "Likewise, in painting, I can do everything possible," he wrote, "as well as any man." Yes, he could. He would go on to create the two most famous paintings in history, The Last Supper and the Mona Lisa. But in his own mind, he was just as much a man of science and engineering, with a passion that was both playful and obsessive. He pursued innovative studies of anatomy, fossils, birds, the heart, flying machines, optics, botany, geology, water flows, and weaponry. Thus he became the archetype of the Renaissance man, an inspiration to all who believe that the infinite works of nature, as he put it, are woven together in a unity filled with marvelous patterns. His ability to combine art and science, made iconic by his drawing of a perfectly proportioned man spread eagle inside a circle and a square, known as Vitruvian Man, which was perhaps a self-portrait, made him history's most creative genius. His scientific explorations informed his art. He peeled flesh off the faces of cadavers, delineated the muscles that move the lips, and then painted the world's most memorable smile. He studied human skulls, made layered drawings of the bones and teeth, and conveyed the skeletal agony of St. Jerome in the wilderness. He explored the mathematics of optics, showed how light rays strike the cornea, and produce magical illusions of changing visual perspectives in The Last Supper. By connecting his studies of light and optics to his art, he mastered the use of shading and perspective to model objects on a two-dimensional surface so they look three-dimensional. This ability to make a flat surface display a body as if modeled and separated from this plane, Leonardo said, was the first intention of the painter. Largely due to his work, dimensionality became the supreme innovation of Renaissance art. As he aged, he pursued his scientific inquiries not just to serve his art, but out of a joyful instinct to fathom the profound beauties of creation. When he groped for a theory of why the sky appears blue, it was not simply to inform his paintings. His curiosity was pure, personal, and delightfully obsessive. But even when he was engaged in blue sky thinking, his science was not a separate endeavor from his art. Together, they served his driving passion, which was nothing less than knowing everything there was to know about the world, including how we fit into it. He had a reverence for the wholeness of nature and a feel for the harmony of its patterns, which he saw replicated in phenomena large and small. In his notebooks, he would record curls of hair, eddies of water, and whirls of air, along with some stabs at the math that might underlie such spirals. While at Windsor Castle, looking at the swirling power of the deluge drawings that he made near the end of his life, I asked the curator, Martin Clayton, whether he thought Leonardo had done them as works of art or of science. Even as I spoke, I realized it was a dumb question. "I do not think that Leonardo would have made that distinction," he replied. I embarked on this book because Leonardo da Vinci is the ultimate example of the main theme of my previous biographies, how the ability to make connections across disciplines, arts and sciences, humanities and technology, is a key to innovation, imagination, and genius. Benjamin Franklin, a previous subject of mine, was a Leonardo of his era. With no formal education, he taught himself to become an imaginative polymath who was Enlightenment America's best scientist, inventor, diplomat, writer, and business strategist. He proved by flying a kite that lightning is electricity, and he invented a rod to tame it. He devised bifocal glasses, enchanting musical instruments, clean-burning stoves, charts of the Gulf Stream, and America's unique style of homespun humor. Albert Einstein, when he was stymied in his pursuit of his theory of relativity, would pull out his violin and play Mozart, which helped him reconnect with the harmonies of the cosmos. Ada Lovelace, whom I profiled in a book on innovators, combined the poetic sensibility of her father, Lord Byron, with her mother's love of the beauty of math to envision a general-purpose computer. And Steve Jobs climaxed his product launches with an image of street signs showing the intersection of the liberal arts and technology. Leonardo was his hero. "He saw beauty in both art and engineering," Jobs said, "and his ability to combine them was what made him a genius." Yes, he was a genius. Wildly imaginative, passionately curious, and creative across multiple disciplines. But we should be wary of that word. Slapping the genius label on Leonardo oddly minimizes him by making it seem as if he were touched by lightning. His early biographer, Giorgio Vasari, a 16th-century artist, made this mistake. "Sometimes in supernatural fashion," he wrote, "a single person is marvelously endowed by heaven with beauty, grace, and talent in such abundance that his every act is divine, and everything he does clearly comes from God rather than from human art." In fact, Leonardo's genius was a human one, wrought by his own will and ambition. It did not come from being the divine recipient, like Newton or Einstein, of a mind with so much processing power that we mere mortals cannot fathom it. Leonardo had almost no schooling and could barely read Latin or do long division. His genius was of the type we can understand, even take lessons from. It was based on skills we can aspire to improve in ourselves, such as curiosity and intense observation. He had an imagination so excitable that it flirted with the edges of fantasy, which is also something we can try to preserve in ourselves and indulge in our children. Leonardo's fantasies pervaded everything he touched: his theatrical productions, plans to divert rivers, designs for ideal cities, schemes for flying machines, and almost every aspect of his art as well as his engineering. His letter to the ruler of Milan is an example, since his military engineering skills then existed mainly in his mind. His initial role at the court was not building weapons, but conjuring up festivals and pageants. Even at the height of his career, most of his fighting and flying contraptions were more visionary than practical. At first, I thought that his susceptibility to fantasia was a failing, revealing a lack of discipline and diligence that was related to his propensity to abandon artworks and treatises unfinished. To some extent, that's true. Vision without execution is hallucination. But I also came to believe that his ability to blur the line between reality and fantasy, just like his sfumato techniques for blurring the lines of a painting, was a key to his creativity. Skill without imagination is barren. Leonardo knew how to marry observation and imagination, which made him history's consummate innovator. My starting point for this book was not Leonardo's art masterpieces, but his notebooks. His mind, I think, is best revealed in the more than 7,200 pages of his notes and scribbles that, miraculously, survive to this day. Paper turns out to be a superb information storage technology, still readable after 500 years, which our own tweets likely won't be. Fortunately, Leonardo could not afford to waste paper, so he crammed every inch of his pages with miscellaneous drawings and looking-glass jottings that seem random but provide intimations of his mental leaps. Scribbled alongside each other, with rhyme if not reason, are math calculations, sketches of his devilish young boyfriend, birds, flying machines, theater props, eddies of water, blood valves, grotesque heads, angels, siphons, plant stems, sawed-apart skulls, tips for painters, notes on the eye and optics, weapons of war, fables, riddles, and studies for paintings. The cross-disciplinary brilliance whirls across every page, providing a delightful display of a mind dancing with nature. His notebooks are the greatest record of curiosity ever created, a wondrous guide to the person whom the eminent art historian Kenneth Clark called the most relentlessly curious man in history. The PDF that accompanies this program shows a sample notebook page that includes a sketch for The Last Supper, as well as other drawings and writings. My favorite gems in his notebooks are his to-do lists, which sparkle with curiosity. One of them, dating from the 1490s in Milan, is that day's list of things he wants to learn. The measurement of Milan and its suburbs is the first entry. This has a practical purpose, as revealed by an item later in the list. Draw Milan. Others show him relentlessly seeking out people whose brains he could pick. Get the master of arithmetic to show you how to square a triangle. S. Giannino, the bombardier, how the Tower of Ferrara is walled. S. Benedetto Bratinari, by what means they walk on ice in Flanders. Get a master of hydraulics to tell you how to repair a lock, canal, and mill in the Lombard manner. Get the measurement of the sun, promise me, by Maestro Giovanni Francesi, the Frenchman. He is insatiable. Over and over again, year after year, Leonardo lists things that he must do and learn. Some involve the type of close observation most of us rarely pause to do. Observe the goose's foot. If it were always open or always closed, the creature would not be able to make any kind of movement. Others involve why is the sky blue questions about phenomena so commonplace that we rarely pause to wonder about them. Why is the fish in water, swifter than the bird in air, when it ought to be the contrary, since water is heavier and thicker than the air. Best of all are the questions that seem completely random. "Describe the tongue of the woodpecker," he instructs himself. Who on earth would decide one day, for no apparent reason, that he wanted to know what the tongue of a woodpecker looks like? How would you even find out? It's not information Leonardo needed to paint a picture, or even to understand the flight of birds, but there it is, and, as we shall see, there are fascinating things to learn about the tongue of the woodpecker. The reason he wanted to know was because he was Leonardo, curious, passionate, and always filled with wonder. Oddest of all, there is this entry. "Go every Saturday to the hot bath, where you will see naked men." We can imagine Leonardo wanting to do that for reasons both anatomical and aesthetic. But did he really need to remind himself to do it? The next item on the list is, "Inflate the lungs of a pig and observe whether they increase in width and in length, or only in width." As the New Yorker art critic Adam Gopnik once wrote, Leonardo remains weird, matchlessly weird, and nothing to be done about it. To wrestle with these issues, I decided to write a book that used these notebooks as its foundation. I started by making pilgrimages to see the originals in Milan, Florence, Paris, Seattle, Madrid, London, and Windsor Castle. That followed Leonardo's injunction to begin any investigation by going to the source. He who can go to the fountain does not go to the water jar. I also immersed myself in the little tap trove of academic articles and doctoral dissertations on Leonardo, each of which represents years of diligent work on very specific topics. In the past few decades, especially since the rediscovery of his codices Madrid in 1965, there have been great advances in the analysis and interpretation of his writings. Likewise, modern technology has revealed new information about his painting and techniques. After immersing myself in Leonardo, I did the best I could to be more observant of phenomena that I used to ignore, making a special effort to notice things the way he did. When I saw sunlight hitting drapes, I pushed myself to pause and look at the way the shadows caressed the folds. I tried to see how light that was reflected from one object subtly colored the shadows of another object. I noticed how the glint of a lustrous spot on a shiny surface moved when I tilted my head. When I looked at a distant tree and a near one, I tried to visualize the lines of perspective. When I saw an eddy of water, I compared it to a ringlet of hair. When I couldn't understand a math concept, I did the best I was able to visualize it. When I saw people at a supper, I studied the relationship of their motions to their emotions. When I saw the hint of a smile come across someone's lips, I tried to fathom her inner mysteries. No, I did not come anywhere close to being Leonardo, mastering his insights or mustering a modicum of his talents. I did not get a millimeter closer to being able to design a glider, invent a new way to draw maps, or paint the Mona Lisa. I had to push myself to be truly curious about the tongue of the woodpecker. But I did learn from Leonardo how a desire to marvel about the world that we encounter each day can make each moment of our lives richer. There are three major early accounts of Leonardo by writers who were almost contemporaries. The painter Giorgio Vasari, born in 1511, 8 years before Leonardo died, wrote the first real art history book, Lives of the Most Eminent Painters, Sculptors, and Architects, in 1550 and came out with a revised version in 1568 that included corrections based on further interviews with people who knew Leonardo, including his pupil Francesco Melzi. A Florentine chauvinist, Vasari gave Leonardo, and especially Michelangelo, the most fulsome treatments for creating what he dubbed, for the first time in print, a renaissance in art. As Huckleberry Finn said of Mark Twain, there were things that Vasari stretched, but he told the truth, mainly. The remainder is a mix of gossip, embellishments, inventions, and unintentional errors. The problem is knowing which picturesque anecdotes, such as Leonardo's teacher throwing down his own brush in awe of his pupil, fall into which category. An anonymous manuscript written in the 1540s, known as the Anonimo Gaudiano, after the family that once owned it, contains colorful details about Leonardo and other Florentines. Once again, some of the assertions, such as that Leonardo lived and worked with Lorenzo de' Medici, may be embellished, but it provides colorful details that ring true, such as that Leonardo liked to wear rose-colored tunics that reached only to his knee, even though others wore long garments. A third early source is by Gian Paolo Lomazzo, a painter who became a writer when he went blind. He wrote an unpublished manuscript called Dreams and Arguments in about 1560, and then published a voluminous treatise on art in 1584. He was a student of a painter who had known Leonardo, and he interviewed Leonardo's pupil, Melzi, so he had access to some first-hand stories. Lomazzo is especially revealing about Leonardo's sexual proclivities. In addition, there are shorter accounts contained in writings by two Leonardo contemporaries, Antonio Bili, a Florentine merchant, and Paolo Giovio, an Italian physician and historian. Many of these early accounts mention Leonardo's looks and personality. He is described as a man of eye-catching beauty and grace. He had flowing golden curls, a muscular build, remarkable physical strength, and an elegance of bearing when he was walking through town in his colorful garb or riding on a horse. Beautiful in person and aspect, Leonardo was well-proportioned and graceful, according to the Anonimo. In addition, he was a charming conversationalist and a lover of nature, renowned for being sweet and gentle to both people and animals. There is less agreement about certain specifics. In the course of my research, I discovered that many facts about Leonardo's life, from the site of his birth to the scene of his death, have been the subject of debate, mythology, and mystery. I try to give my best assessment and then describe the controversies and counterarguments in the notes. I also discovered, at first to my consternation and then to my pleasure, that Leonardo was not always a giant. He made mistakes. He went off on tangents, literally pursuing math problems that became time-sucking diversions. Notoriously, he left many of his paintings unfinished, most notably the Adoration of the Magi, St. Jerome in the Wilderness, and the Battle of Anghiari. As a result, there exist now at most 15 paintings fully or mainly attributable to him. Although generally considered by his contemporaries to be friendly and gentle, Leonardo was at times dark and troubled. His notebooks and drawings are a window into his fevered, imaginative, manic, and sometimes elated mind. Had he been a student at the outset of the 21st century, he may have been put on a pharmaceutical regimen to alleviate his mood swings and attention deficit disorder. One need not subscribe to the artist as troubled genius trope to believe that we are fortunate that Leonardo was left to his own devices to slay his demons while conjuring up his dragons. In one of the quirky riddles in his notebooks is this clue huge figures will appear in human shape, and the nearer you get to them, the more their immense size will diminish. The answer? The shadow cast by a man at night with a light. Although the same may be said of Leonardo, I believe he is, in fact, not diminished by being discovered to be human. Both his shadow and his reality deserve to loom large. His lapses and oddities allow us to relate to him, to feel that we might emulate him, and to appreciate his moments of triumph even more. The 15th century of Leonardo and Columbus and Gutenberg was a time of invention, exploration, and the spread of knowledge by new technologies. In short, it was a time like our own. That is why we have so much to learn from Leonardo. His ability to combine art, science, technology, the humanities, and imagination remains an enduring recipe for creativity. So too was his ease at being a bit of a misfit, illegitimate, gay, vegetarian, left-handed, easily distracted, and at times heretical. Florence flourished in the 15th century because it was comfortable with such people. Above all, Leonardo's relentless curiosity and experimentation should remind us of the importance of instilling in both ourselves and our children not just received knowledge, but a willingness to question it, to be imaginative and, like talented misfits and rebels in any era, to think different.
Chapter 1. Childhood. Vinci, 1452 to 1464. Da Vinci. Leonardo da Vinci had the good luck to be born out of wedlock. Otherwise, he would have been expected to become a notary, like the first-born legitimate sons in his family stretching back at least 5 generations. His family roots can be traced back to the early 1300s, when his great-great-great-grandfather, Michele, practiced as a notary in the Tuscan hill town of Vinci, about 17 miles west of Florence. With the rise of Italy's mercantile economy, notaries played an important role drawing up commercial contracts, land sales, wills, and other legal documents in Latin, often garnishing them with historical references and literary flourishes. Because Michele was a notary, he was entitled to the honorific Ser, and thus became known as Ser Michele da Vinci. His son and grandson were even more successful notaries, the latter becoming a chancellor of Florence. The next in line, Antonio, was an anomaly. He used the honorific Ser and married the daughter of a notary, but he seems to have lacked the da Vinci ambition. He mostly spent his life living off the proceeds from family lands tilled by sharecroppers that produced a modest amount of wine, olive oil, and wheat. Antonio's son Piero made up for the lassitude by ambitiously pursuing success in Pistola and Pisa, and then, by about 1451, when he was 25, establishing himself in Florence. A contract he notarized that year gave his work address as at the Palazzo del Podestà, the magistrate's building, now the Bargello Museum, facing the Palazzo della Signoria, the seat of government. He became a notary for many of the city's monasteries and religious orders, the town's Jewish community, and on at least one occasion, the Medici family. On one of his visits back to Vinci, Piero had a relationship with an unmarried local peasant girl, and in the spring of 1452, they had a son. Exercising his little-used notarial handwriting, the boy's grandfather, Antonio, recorded the birth on the bottom of the last page of a notebook that had belonged to his own grandfather. 1452, there was born to me a grandson, the son of Ser Piero, my son, on the 15th day of April, a Saturday, at the 3rd hour of the night, about 10 p.m. He bears the name Leonardo. Leonardo's mother was not considered worth mentioning in Antonio's birth notation, nor in any other birth or baptism record. From a tax document 5 years later, we learn only her first name, Katerina. Her identity was long a mystery to modern scholars. She was thought to be in her mid-twenties, and some researchers speculated that she was an Arab slave, or perhaps a Chinese slave. In fact, she was an orphaned and impoverished 16-year-old from the Vinci area named Katerina Lippi. Proving that there are still things to be rediscovered about Leonardo, the art historian Martin Kemp of Oxford and the archival researcher Giuseppe Palanti of Florence produced evidence in 2017 documenting her background. Born in 1436 to a poor farmer, Katerina was orphaned when she was 14. She and her infant brother moved in with their grandmother, who died a year later in 1451. Left to fend for herself and her brother, Katerina had a relationship in July of that year with Piero da Vinci, then 24, who was prominent and prosperous. There was little likelihood they would marry. Although described by one earlier biographer as of good blood, Katerina was of a different social class, and Piero was probably already betrothed to his future wife, an appropriate match, a 16-year-old named Albiera, who was the daughter of a prominent Florentine shoemaker. He and Albiera were wed within 8 months of Leonardo's birth. The marriage, socially and professionally advantageous to both sides, had likely been arranged, and the dowry contracted before Leonardo was born. Keeping things tidy and convenient, shortly after Leonardo was born, Piero helped to set up a marriage for Katerina to a local farmer and kiln worker who had ties to the da Vinci family. Named Antonio di Piero del Vacca, he was called a Catabriga, which means troublemaker, though fortunately he does not seem to have been one. Leonardo's paternal grandparents and his father had a family house with a small garden right next to the walls of the castle in the heart of the village of Vinci. That is where Leonardo may have been born, though there are reasons to think not. It might not have been convenient or appropriate to have a pregnant and then breastfeeding peasant woman living in the crowded da Vinci family home, especially as Ser Piero was negotiating a dowry from the prominent family whose daughter he was planning to marry. Instead, according to legend and the local tourist industry, Leonardo's birthplace may have been a grey stone tenant cottage next to a farmhouse 2 miles up the road from Vinci in the adjacent hamlet of Anchiano, which is now the site of a small Leonardo museum. Some of this property had been owned since 1412 by the family of Piero di Malvolto, a close friend of the da Vinci's. He was the godfather of Piero da Vinci and in 1452 would be a godfather of Piero's newborn son Leonardo, which would have made sense if Leonardo had been born on his property. The families were very close. Leonardo's grandfather Antonio had served as a witness to a contract involving some parts of Piero di Malvolto's property. The notes describing the exchange say that Antonio was at a nearby house playing backgammon when he was asked to come over for that task. Piero da Vinci would buy some of the property in the 1480s. At the time of Leonardo's birth, Piero di Malvolto's 70-year-old widowed mother lived on the property. So here, in the hamlet of Anchiano, an easy 2 mile walk from the village of Vinci, living alone in a farmhouse that had a run-down cottage next door, was a widow who was a trusted friend to at least 2 generations of the da Vinci family. Her dilapidated cottage, for tax purposes the family claimed it as uninhabitable, may have been the ideal place to shelter Katerina while she was pregnant, as per local law. Leonardo was born on a Saturday, and the following day he was baptized by the local priest at the parish church of Vinci, as seen in the PDF. The baptismal font is still there. Despite the circumstances of his birth, it was a large and public event. There were 10 godparents giving witness, including Piero di Malvolto, far more than the average at the church, and the guests included prominent local gentry. A week later, Piero da Vinci left Katerina and their infant son behind and returned to Florence, where that Monday he was in his office notarizing papers for clients. Leonardo left us no comment on the circumstances of his birth, but there is one tantalizing allusion in his notebooks to the favors that nature bestows upon a love child. The man who has intercourse aggressively and uneasily will produce children who are irritable and untrustworthy, he wrote. But if the intercourse is done with great love and desire on both sides, the child will be of great intellect, witty, lively, and lovable. One assumes, or at least hopes, that he considered himself in the latter category. He split his childhood between two homes. Caterina and Acatabriga settled on a small farm on the outskirts of Vinci, and they remained friendly with Piero da Vinci. 20 years later, Acatabriga was working in a kiln that was rented by Piero, and they served as witnesses for each other on a few contracts and deeds over the years. In the years following Leonardo's birth, Caterina and Acatabriga had 4 girls and a boy. Piero and Albiera, however, remained childless. In fact, until Leonardo was 24, his father had no other children. Piero would make up for it during his 3rd and 4th marriages, having at least 11 children. With his father living mainly in Florence and his mother nurturing a growing family of her own, Leonardo by age 5 was primarily living in the da Vinci family home with his leisure-loving grandfather Antonio and his wife. In the 1457 tax census, Antonio listed the dependents residing with him, including his grandson. Leonardo, son of the said Ser Piero, non legittimo, born of him and of Caterina, who is now the woman of Acatabriga. Also living in the household was Piero's youngest brother, Francesco, who was only 15 years older than his nephew Leonardo. Francesco inherited a love of country leisure and was described in a tax document by his own father, in a pot calling the kettle way, as one who hangs around the villa and does nothing. He became Leonardo's beloved uncle, and at times, surrogate father. In the first edition of his biography, Vasari makes the telling mistake, later corrected, of identifying Piero as Leonardo's uncle. A Golden Age for Bastards. As Leonardo's well-attended baptism attests, being born out of wedlock was not a cause for public shame. The 19th-century cultural historian Jacob Burckhardt went so far as to label Renaissance Italy a golden age for bastards. Especially among the ruling and aristocratic classes, being illegitimate was no hindrance. Pius II, who was the Pope when Leonardo was born, wrote about visiting Ferrara, where his welcoming party included 7 princes from the ruling Este family, among them the reigning Duke, all born out of wedlock. "It is an extraordinary thing about that family," Pius wrote, "that no legitimate heir has ever inherited the principate. The sons of their mistresses have been so much more fortunate than those of their wives." Pius himself fathered at least 2 illegitimate children. Pope Alexander VI, also during Leonardo's lifetime, had multiple mistresses and illegitimate children, one of whom was Cesare Borgia, who became a cardinal, commander of the papal armies, an employer of Leonardo, and the subject of Machiavelli's The Prince. For members of the middle classes, however, illegitimacy was not as readily accepted. Protective of their new status, merchants and professionals formed guilds that enforced moral strictures. Although some of the guilds accepted the illegitimate sons of their members, that was not the case with the Arte dei Giudici e Notai, the venerable guild of judges and notaries, founded in 1197, to which Leonardo's father belonged. The notary was a certified witness and scribe, Thomas Kuhn wrote in Illegitimacy in Renaissance Florence. His trustworthiness had to be above reproach. He had to be someone fully in the mainstream of society. These strictures had an upside. Illegitimacy freed some imaginative and free-spirited young men to be creative at a time when creativity was increasingly rewarded. Among the poets, artists, and artisans born out of wedlock were Petrarch, Boccaccio, Lorenzo Ghiberti, Filippo Lippi, his son Filippino, Leon Battista Alberti, and, of course, Leonardo. Being born out of wedlock was more complex than merely being an outsider. It created an ambiguity of status. "The problem with bastards was that they were part of the family, but not totally," wrote Kuhn. that helped some be, or forced them to be, more adventurous and improvisational. Leonardo was a member of a middle-class family, but separate from it. Like so many writers and artists, he grew up feeling a part of the world, but also detached. This limbo extended to inheritance. A combination of conflicting laws and contradictory court precedents left it unclear whether a son born out of wedlock could be an heir, as Leonardo was to find out in legal battles with his stepbrothers many years later. Management of such ambiguities was one of the hallmarks of life in a Renaissance city-state, explained Kuhn. It was related to the more celebrated creativity of a city like Florence in the arts and humanism. Because Florence's guild of notaries barred those who were non legittimo, Leonardo was able to benefit from the note-taking instincts that were ingrained in his family heritage while being free to pursue his own creative passions. This was fortunate. He would have made a poor notary. He got bored and distracted too easily, especially when a project became routine rather than creative. Disciple of experience. Another upside for Leonardo of being born out of wedlock was that he was not sent to one of the Latin schools that taught the classics and humanities to well-groomed aspiring professionals and merchants of the early Renaissance. Other than a little training in commercial math at what was known as an abacus school, Leonardo was mainly self-taught. He often seemed defensive about being an unlettered man, as he dubbed himself with some irony. But he also took pride that his lack of formal schooling led him to be a disciple of experience and experiment. Leonardo da Vinci, discepolo dell'esperienza, he once signed himself. This free-thinking attitude saved him from being an acolyte of traditional thinking. In his notebooks, he unleashed a blast at what he called the pompous fools who would disparage him for this. I am fully aware that my not being a man of letters may cause certain presumptuous people to think that they may with reason blame me, alleging that I am a man without learning. Foolish folk! They strut about, puffed up and pompous, decked out and adorned, not with their own labours, but by those of others. They will say that because I have no book learning, I cannot properly express what I desire to describe, but they do not know that my subjects require experience rather than the words of others. Thus was Leonardo spared from being trained to accept dusty scholasticism or the medieval dogmas that had accumulated in the centuries since the decline of classical science and original thinking. His lack of reverence for authority and his willingness to challenge received wisdom would lead him to craft an empirical approach for understanding nature that foreshadowed the scientific method developed more than a century later by Bacon and Galileo. His method was rooted in experiment, curiosity, and the ability to marvel at phenomena that the rest of us rarely pause to ponder after we've outgrown our wonder years. To that was added an intense desire and ability to observe the wonders of nature. He pushed himself to perceive shapes and shadows with wondrous precision. He was particularly good at apprehending movement, from the motions of a flapping wing to the emotions flickering across a face. On this foundation he built experiments, some conducted in his mind, others with drawings, and a few with physical objects. "First, I shall do some experiments before I proceed further," he announced, "because my intention is to consult experience first, and then, with reasoning, show why such experience is bound to operate in such a way." It was a good time for a child with such ambitions and talents to be born. In 1452, Johannes Gutenberg had just opened his publishing house, and soon others were using his movable type press to print books that would empower unschooled but brilliant people like Leonardo. Italy was beginning a rare 40-year period during which it was not racked by wars among its city-states. Literacy, numeracy, and income were rising dramatically as power shifted from titled landowners to urban merchants and bankers who benefited from advances in law, accounting, credit, and insurance. The Ottoman Turks were about to capture Constantinople, unleashing on Italy a migration of fleeing scholars with bundles of manuscripts containing the ancient wisdom of Euclid, Ptolemy, Plato, and Aristotle. Born within a year of Leonardo were Christopher Columbus and Amerigo Vespucci, who would lead an era of exploration, and Florence, with its booming merchant class of status-seeking patrons, had become the cradle of Renaissance art and humanism. Childhood memories. The most vivid memory Leonardo had of his infancy was one he recorded 50 years later, when he was studying the flight of birds. He was writing about a hawk-like bird called a kite, which has a forked tail and elegant long wings that allow it to soar and glide. Observing it with his typical acuity, Leonardo perceived precisely how it opened its wings and then spread and lowered its tail when it landed. This aroused a memory from when he was a baby. Writing about the kite seems to be my destiny, since among the first recollections of my infancy, it seemed to me that, as I was in my cradle, a kite came to me and opened my mouth with its tail and struck me several times with its tail inside my lips. Like much of what came from Leonardo's mind, there was probably some fantasy and fabulism in the brew. It is hard to imagine a bird actually landing in a cradle and prying open a baby's mouth with its tail, and Leonardo appears to acknowledge this by using the phrase, "it seemed to me," as if it were perhaps partly a dream. All of this, a childhood with two mothers, an often absent father, and a dreamlike oral encounter with a flapping tail, would provide great fodder for a Freudian analyst. And it did, from Freud himself. In 1910, Freud used the kite tale as the foundation for a short book, Leonardo da Vinci and a Memory of His Childhood. Freud got off to a stumbling start by using a poor German translation of Leonardo's note that mistakenly called the bird a vulture rather than a kite. This sent him into a long, tangential explanation about the symbolism of vultures in ancient Egypt and the etymological relationship of the words for vulture and mother, all of which was irrelevant, and Freud later admitted, embarrassing. Leaving aside the bird mix-up, the main thrust of Freud's analysis was that the word for tail in many languages, including Italian, coda, is slang for penis, and that Leonardo's memory was related to his homosexuality. The situation contained in the fantasy, that a vulture opened the mouth of the child and forcefully belabored it with its tail, corresponds to the idea of fellatio, Freud wrote. Leonardo's repressed desires, he speculated, were channeled into his feverish creativity, but he left many works unfinished because he was inhibited. These interpretations have prompted some devastating critiques, most famously by art historian Meyer Shapiro, and they seem, at least to me, to reveal more about Freud than about Leonardo. Biographers should be cautious about psychoanalyzing someone who lived five centuries earlier. Leonardo's dreamlike memory may have simply reflected his lifelong interest in the flight of birds, which is how he framed it. And it does not take a Freud to understand that sexual drives can be sublimated into ambition and other passions. Leonardo said so himself. "Intellectual passion drives out sensuality," he wrote in one of his notebooks. A better source for insight into Leonardo's formative character and motivations is another personal memory he recorded, this one about hiking near Florence. The recollection involved chancing upon a dark cave and pondering whether he should enter. "Having wandered some distance among gloomy rocks, I came to the mouth of a great cavern, in front of which I stood some time astonished," he recalled. "Bending back and forth, I tried to see whether I could discover anything inside, but the darkness within prevented that. Suddenly there arose in me two contrary emotions, fear and desire. Fear of the threatening dark cave, desire to see whether there were any marvellous things within." Desire won. His unstoppable curiosity triumphed, and Leonardo went into the cave. There, he discovered, embedded in the wall, a fossil whale. "Oh, mighty and once living instrument of nature," he wrote, "your vast strength was to no avail." Some scholars have assumed that he was describing a fantasy hike or riffing on some verses by Seneca. But his notebook page and those surrounding it are filled with descriptions of layers of fossil shells, and many fossilized whale bones have in fact been discovered in Tuscany. The whale fossil triggered a dark vision of what would be, throughout his life, one of his deepest forebodings, that of an apocalyptic deluge. On the next side of the sheet, he described at length the furious power once held by the long-dead whale. "You lashed with swift branching fins and forked tail, creating in the sea sudden tempests that buffeted and submerged ships." Then he turned philosophical. "Oh, time, swift despoiler of all things, how many kings, how many nations hast thou undone? And how many changes of states and of circumstances have happened since this wondrous fish perished?" By this point, Leonardo's fears were about a realm far different from whatever dangers might be lurking inside the cave. Instead, they were driven by an existential dread in the face of the destructive powers of nature. He began scribbling rapidly, using a silver point on a red-tinted page, describing an apocalypse that begins with water and ends with fire. "The rivers will be deprived of their waters. The earth will no longer put forth her greenery. The fields will no more be decked with waving corn. All the animals, finding no fresh grass for pasture, will die," he wrote. "In this way the fertile and fruitful earth will be forced to end with the element of fire, and then its surface will be left burnt up to cinder, and this will be the end of all earthly nature." The dark cave that Leonardo's curiosity compelled him to enter offered up both scientific discoveries and imaginative fantasies, strands that would be interwoven throughout his life. He would weather storms, literally and psychologically, and he would encounter dark recesses of the earth and soul. But his curiosity about nature would always impel him to explore more. Both his fascinations and his forebodings would be expressed in his art, beginning with his depiction of Saint Jerome agonizing near the mouth of a cave, and culminating in his drawings and writings about an apocalyptic deluge. Chapter 2. Apprentice. The Move. Until he was 12, Leonardo had a life in Vinci that, despite the complexities of being part of an extended family, was quite settled. He lived primarily with his grandparents and his idle uncle Francesco in the family house in the heart of Vinci. His father and stepmother were listed as living there when Leonardo was 5, but after that their primary residence was in Florence. Leonardo's mother and her husband lived with their growing brood of children, along with Acatabriga's parents and his brother's family, in a farmhouse an easy walk from town. But in 1464 this world was disrupted. His stepmother, Albiera, died in childbirth, along with what would have been her first child. Leonardo's grandfather, Antonio, the head of the Vinci household, also had recently died. So just as Leonardo was reaching the age when he needed to prepare for a trade, his father, living alone and probably lonely, brought him to Florence. Leonardo rarely wrote in his notebooks about his own emotions, so it is hard to know what he felt about the move. But the fables he recorded sometimes give a glimpse of his sentiments. One described the sad odyssey of a stone perched on a hill, surrounded by colourful flowers and a grove of trees, in other words, a place like Vinci. Looking at the crowd of stones along the road below, it decided it wanted to join them. "What am I doing here among these plants?" the stone asked. "I want to live in the company of my fellow stones." So it rolled down to the others. After a while, Leonardo recounted, it found itself in continual distress from the wheels of the carts, the iron hoofs of horses, and the feet of the passers-by. One rolled it over, another trod upon it. Sometimes the stone raised itself up a little as it lay covered with mud or the dung of some animal, but it was in vain that it looked up at the spot whence it had come as a place of solitude and tranquil peace. Leonardo drew a moral. This is what happens to those who leave a life of solitary contemplation and choose to come to dwell in cities among people full of infinite evil. His notebooks have many other maxims praising the countryside and solitude. "Leave your family and friends and go over the mountains and valleys into the country," he instructed aspiring painters. "While you are alone, you are entirely your own master." These paeans to country living are romantic and, for those who cherish the image of lonely genius, quite appealing. But they are infused with fantasy. Leonardo would spend almost all of his career in Florence, Milan, and Rome, crowded centres of creativity and commerce, usually surrounded by students, companions, and patrons. He rarely retreated alone to the countryside for an extended period of solitude. Like many artists, he was stimulated by being with people of diverse interests and, willing to contradict himself in his notebooks, declared, "Drawing in company is much better than alone." The impulses of his grandfather and uncle, who both practiced the quiet country life, were imprinted in Leonardo's imagination, but not practiced in his life. During his early years in Florence, Leonardo lived with his father, who arranged for him to get a rudimentary education and would soon help him get a good apprenticeship and commissions. But there is one significant thing that Ser Piero did not do, which would have been easy enough for a well-connected notary: go through the legal process of having his son legitimated. This could be accomplished by the father and child appearing before a local official, known as a Count Palatine, usually a dignitary who had been granted power to act on such matters, and presenting a petition as the child knelt. Piero's decision not to do this for Leonardo is particularly surprising, since he then had no other children of his own. Perhaps one reason that Piero did not legitimate Leonardo was that he hoped to have as his heir a son who would follow family tradition and become a notary. And it was already clear by the time Leonardo turned 12 that he was not so inclined. According to Vasari, Piero noticed that his son never ceased drawing and sculpting, pursuits which suited his fancy more than any other. In addition, the notary guild had a rule, which may have been difficult to circumvent, that denied membership even to out-of-wedlock sons who had been legitimated. So Piero apparently saw no reason to go through the process. By not legitimating Leonardo, he could hope to have another son who would be his heir as a notary. A year later, Piero married the daughter of another prominent Florence notary, but it would only be after his third marriage in 1475 to a woman 6 years younger than Leonardo that he would produce a legitimate heir who indeed became a notary. Florence. There was no place then, and few places ever, that offered a more stimulating environment for creativity than Florence in the 1400s. See the map in the PDF. Its economy, once dominated by unskilled wool spinners, had flourished by becoming one that, like our own time, interwove art, technology, and commerce. It featured artisans working with silk makers and merchants to create fabrics that were works of art. In 1472, there were 84 woodcarvers, 83 silk workers, 30 master painters, and 44 goldsmiths and jewellery craftsmen working in Florence. It was also a centre of banking. The florin, noted for its gold purity, was the dominant standard currency in all of Europe, and the adoption of double-entry bookkeeping that recorded debits and credits permitted commerce to flourish. Its leading thinkers embraced a Renaissance humanism that put its faith in the dignity of the individual and in the aspiration to find happiness on this earth through knowledge. Fully a third of Florence's population was literate, the highest rate in Europe. By embracing trade, it became a centre of finance and a cauldron of ideas. Beautiful Florence has all seven of the fundamental things a city requires for perfection, the essayist Benedetto Dei wrote in 1472 when Leonardo was living there. First of all, it enjoys complete liberty. Second, it has a large, rich, and elegantly dressed population. Third, it has a river with clear, pure water and mills within its walls. Fourth, it rules over castles, towns, lands, and people. Fifth, it has a university, and both Greek and accounting are taught. Sixth, it has masters in every art. Seventh, it has banks and business agents all over the world. Each one of those assets was valuable for a city, just as they are today. Not only the liberty and pure water, but also that the population was elegantly dressed, and that the university was renowned for teaching accounting as well as Greek. The city's cathedral was the most beautiful in Italy. In the 1430s, it had been crowned with the world's largest dome, built by the architect Filippo Brunelleschi, which was a triumph of both art and engineering, and linking those two disciplines was a key to Florence's creativity. Many of the city's artists were also architects, and its fabric industry had been built by combining technology, design, chemistry, and commerce. This mixing of ideas from different disciplines became the norm as people of diverse talents intermingled. Silk makers worked with gold beaters to create enchanted fashions. Architects and artists developed the science of perspective. Woodcarvers worked with architects to adorn the city's 108 churches. Shops became studios. Merchants became financiers. Artisans became artists. When Leonardo arrived, Florence's population was 40,000, which is about what it had been for a century, but down from the 100,000 or so who lived there in 1300, before the Black Death and subsequent waves of plague. There were at least 100 families that could be considered very wealthy, plus some 5,000 guild members, shopkeepers and merchants who were part of a prosperous middle class. Because most of them were new to wealth, they had to establish and assert their status. They did so by commissioning distinctive works of art, buying luxurious clothes of silk and gold, building palatial mansions, 30 went up between 1450 and 1470, and becoming patrons of literature, poetry, and humanist philosophy. Consumption was conspicuous but tasteful. By the time Leonardo arrived, Florence had more woodcarvers than butchers. The city itself had become a work of art. "There is no place more beautiful in all the world," the poet Ugolino Verino wrote. Unlike some city-states elsewhere in Italy, Florence was not ruled by hereditary royalty. More than a century before Leonardo arrived, the most prosperous merchants and guild leaders crafted a republic whose elected delegates met at the Palazzo della Signoria, now known as the Palazzo Vecchio. The people were kept amused every day by shows, festivals, and novelties. The 15th-century Florentine historian Francesco Guicciardini wrote, "They were well-fed from the provisions with which the city abounded. Industry of every sort flourished. Talented and able men were maintained, and a welcome and a position secured to all teachers of literature, art, and every liberal pursuit." The Republic was not, however, democratic or egalitarian. In fact, it was barely a republic. Exercising power from behind its facade was the Medici family, the phenomenally wealthy bankers who dominated Florentine politics and culture during the 15th century without holding office or hereditary title. In the following century, they became hereditary dukes, and lesser family members became popes. After Cosimo de' Medici took over the family bank in the 1430s, it became the largest in Europe. By managing the fortunes of the continent's wealthy families, the Medici made themselves the wealthiest of them all. They were innovators in bookkeeping, including the use of debit and credit accounting that became one of the great spurs to progress during the Renaissance. By means of payoffs and plotting, Cosimo became the de facto ruler of Florence, and his patronage made it the cradle of Renaissance art and humanism. A collector of ancient manuscripts who had been schooled in Greek